This is an ABC podcast.
A small mine in Western Australia's goldfields proves a rich hunting ground for gold explorers.
It's becoming less rare, isn't it?
Yeah, it's becoming a bit of a first world mining problem, this one. We've got finding great little pockets of gold. We're still in the right geologic environment, so we do expect hopefully to find some more in the near future as well.
And a Northern Territory Council looks to restore public trust by letting residents have a greater say in the community's future.
They are doing a better job than previously with young people, and I'm happy with the way they're handling things. So this plan, I had a read of it, and I like the way it represents us rather than what council wants, but what the community wants.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. Australia is known for its big things, the big pineapple, the big banana, and now Australia has been recognised as being home to one of the world's biggest dinosaurs. Nicknamed Cooper after its discovery in the Cooper Basin of southwest Queensland, the titanosaur sauropod is as long as a basketball court and as tall as a three-storey building. And now, after years of painstaking evacuation, the Erromanga Natural History Museum has officially identified the skeleton as the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia. Our reporter Ellie Grounds has been in Erromanga for the formal proceedings. She's been there for a few days now. Now, Ellie, can you introduce us to Cooper? What would this prehistoric giant have looked like?
Well, Sinead, Cooper is the largest dinosaur to have ever roamed Australia's land, and now it has an official title, Australotitan cooperensis. So what it would have looked like, it's a sauropod, which is the dinosaurs with the long necks. People might be familiar with a brontosaurus, that's probably the most recognisable. And it grew up to 30 metres in length, up to 6.5 metres high at the hip, and weighed up to 67 tonnes. So it really is one big, big animal that lived about 95 million years ago.
Now, Cooper has only recently been scientifically recognised, but when was he originally first discovered?
He was first discovered back in 2006, so it's been a 15-year process to get this new genus and species officially recognised. He was discovered by a couple that live out here near Erromanga in southwest Queensland called Robin and Stuart McKenzie. They were out mustering cattle on their property and they just happened across these dinosaur bones. They knew what they were looking for because it wasn't the first time they had discovered dinosaur bones on their property, but these ones were certainly very different. So that they, you know, packed them up, put them on the back of their motorbike, brought them back with them to their home, and it started this 15-year-long process to get to Australia's newest and largest dinosaur.
It's just such a fantastic story. But what's been the process then to get Cooper from being that outback discovery that's been shoved in the back of a bike to being scientifically recognised?
So once Robin and Stuart thought they, you know, had a hunch that this was something, they got in touch with the Queensland Museum, and it all kind of went from there. So paleontologist Dr. Scott Hocknell, he's the guy that's been behind this, the driving force for the last 15 years. He was the one who named Cooper's official scientific name, and he explains kind of the process that he and his team went through to get to this point.
Well, it started out actually in 2004 when their son Sandy Jr. found the first chunk of bone, and they brought it into the Queensland Museum, not really sure whether it was bone, dinosaur bone or not, showed it to our senior technician there, Joanne Wilkinson, and she'd been out on dinosaur digs with myself and the rest of the museum out in Winton, so we knew what dinosaur bone looked like from this kind of country, and sure enough it was a little piece. And when we came out here, we investigated a number of sites, and another specimen called George revealed to us this enormous bone, and this is a thigh bone, and the thigh bone was much bigger than anything else we'd seen before, but it wasn't enough to go on, so we started an excavation, and literally only a kilometre away from George's site, there's this other site, and the bones clicked together on the surface. It was very exciting, and as we dug underneath the ground, we realised we had complete bones, and not just complete bones, but huge bones, 1.5 metre long arm bones, 1.9 metre long thigh bones, pelvic girdles. We knew at that stage that we had something big, but we didn't know whether it was a different species to the other dinosaurs found in Winton or whether it was something completely new.
That's Dr. Scott Hocknell. Now, Ellie, where does Cooper sit in the ranks of largest prehistoric giants? Like, where does he sit in the ranks there?
Well, he's pretty high up now. So previously, these kind of dinosaurs called titanosaurs, the biggest animals to ever roam the earth, it was thought that they had only ever been discovered in South America. So as I said earlier, Cooper is about 67 tons, and the biggest dinosaur that has been discovered previously, the Patago Titan from South America, weighs in at about 69 tons. So it's really, he's not too far behind. He's probably in the top 10 to 15 biggest dinosaurs in the world. So this really puts Australia as a whole and Southwest Queensland, and specifically the town of Erromanga, on the map. It's certainly making headlines around the world. The people at the museum here have been on the phone to media all of last night and all this morning from around the world, talking to the New York Times, Al Jazeera, every outlet in Australia. So it's certainly a huge, huge discovery.
It's pretty exciting. So what about the area, Ellie? Is it an area that's rich in dinosaur fossils and bones? It seems from what Dr. Scott Hocknell was saying there that it is.
It certainly is. So since Sandy Jr. found those first bones in 2004, it kind of really hasn't stopped. So the Erromanga Natural History Museum runs very regular digs, and they were actually out on a site that they only finished their dig up last week, and they found some new bones there that they think will be another new species. So now they're kind of starting the exact same process all over again. And so I've been here in the shed at the museum for the last few days, where they just have shelves and shelves of fossils sitting there in jackets, just waiting for people to come and prep and do all the work on them. So it certainly is an area that's rich in fossils and bones. And everybody that I've spoken to says that Cooper being officially scientifically described, that's not the end of the journey. It's really only the beginning and the tip of the iceberg.
So what's all this going to mean to the region? I can imagine it's going to be a huge attraction.
Oh, it certainly is. Paleotourism in Western Queensland is already booming. There is an official dinosaur trail which takes tourists through a number of towns in Western Queensland that are known for their dinosaur discoveries and have museums or attractions set up to honour those dinosaurs. People might be familiar with the Age of Dinosaurs in Winton. There's also attractions in Muddaburra, Huendon and Richmond. So at the moment, the paleotourism industry is actually one of the niche parts of the tourism industry that's doing well, thanks to Australia's border closure. Domestic tourists are just flocking here in droves. But given that this is worldwide international scientific news, everybody's hoping that once Australia's international border opens, that dinosaur fans from around the world will be flocking here as well.
How fantastic. Ellie Grounds in Erromanga. Thanks for talking to Australia Wide.
Thank you, Sinead.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
Now, humpback whales are the largest animals to have ever lived, and they've been even bigger than dinosaurs. So you can imagine two men surprised when one breached and landed on their boat off the far south coast of New South Wales. Whales are very intelligent creatures with acute awareness of what's around them, so the accident is most unusual. Both men were injured, and the 18-year-old passenger was airlifted to Canberra with serious injuries. The Australian Vice President of the Organisation for the Rescue and Research of Cetaceans, Jules Farrell, said the incident highlighted the need to stick to the rules.
That is why there are legal distances that people do need to stay away from boats, which is 100 metres from a single whale. It's 300 metres from a mother and a calf. And if you're fortunate enough to come across an igloo, it's 500 metres.
Oh.
And the reason that they have those distances of 100 metres is that for this reason, because whales can just come out of nowhere and breach. And with the amount of whales that we have migrating up the coast at the moment, there's a lot more whales out there every year. The population is increasing by 10 to 11%.
That's the Australian Vice President of the Organisation for the Rescue and Research of Cetaceans. And she mentioned Migaloo there, who's the most well-known humpback whale off Australia's coast. And I believe he's Snow White.
One of the questions was, Dane, do you remember when Grandad tipped the backhoe over out at the ball?
ABC Australia Wide.
And it was like, bzz, bzz. I thought, okie doke, that thing works.
On ABC Radio.
A national body for backpacker and youth tourism says there's only about a quarter of the number of working holidaymakers in Australia that there usually is. And this has forced many backpacker hostels to close while others are on the market. In Mildura, a backpacker hostel that's been unoccupied since November is getting a makeover. And when it reopens, it will be used to accommodate Pacific Islanders who are in the region for seasonal work. Kelly Hollingworth caught up with John George, who'll manage the property on behalf of the new owners.
In general, we want people to be comfortable and feel like they're part of our family, even though a slightly different family to the ones that we've had over a number of years.
When the federal budget was handed down, the indication was that international borders may reopen in about 12 months' time, so mid-next year. Do you expect that backpackers will return to Australia to do seasonal work when that happens?
I think backpackers will return to Australia, but I suspect that the visa requirements will alter, and I think that hopefully by then the government will have done something to address the chronic labour shortage across almost every sector in Australia, and that there'll be an expansion or an embedding of the Pacific Islander and the seasonal worker programs, probably for two reasons. One, because that's a source of labour, and the other one because it enables Australia's presence in the South Pacific to remain visible against some of the other Asian pressures that there are.
So if backpackers do return and they come to regional areas like Mildura, do you think there'll be places for them to stay still?
I think there'll be some, and I suspect that it may well be that with the number of backpacker hostels that have closed in the area, I suspect other people will come along and take advantage or see opportunities in providing accommodation. What we see now is an awful lot of more experienced backpackers, shall we say, not people in their first year on working holiday visas. We see the people that have been here now for 2 years, possibly going into their third year, and they're looking for accommodation in share houses and so on. They're not looking for the one-stop shop that a backpacker hostel can provide with accommodation, with transport, with work. They can source work themselves, and they have their own vehicles. And they're looking for probably something a little bit more personal than possibly some backpacker hostels are able to provide.
Just a few blocks away, Mildura real estate agent Mark Thornton is selling the Oasis Backpackers. The 25-bedroom property can accommodate 100 people, and it can be all yours if you have between $1.3 and $1.5 million.
It's been on the market for 3 weeks. We've had a fair bit of local interest, a lot from Melbourne as well. And a range of different requirements from different buyers. So it'll be interesting once we get the result, you know, what the ultimate buyer will do with the property, because it's been very, you know, there's been some interest to continue it on as a backpackers, particularly from Melbourne. There's been other interest from purely just land value to potentially develop the actual the property itself, and then some other potential interest to continue it for accommodation, but not backpacker related.
How much has the coronavirus pandemic influenced the owner's decision to sell the property?
It's absolutely influenced them, and it's not viable for them to continue because there's no backpackers in Australia at the moment. Well, there may be a few, but very minimal compared to the norm. So, you know, I think naturally you can understand that these guys are not just the owners here, but other hostel owners around Sunraysia are probably not enjoying the current situation with what's happened with COVID and the lack of backpackers in Australia. So naturally, I think, you know, they'd still be running it in a great way. They've owned it for a long time. They've really taken care of the property and the people that have come through as the backpackers. But it's obviously forced their hand to sell.
Mildura real estate agent Mark Thornton ending Kelly Hollingworth's story. When the city of Palmerston Council near Darwin was dismissed for poor governance, the public lost trust, leaving its reputation in tatters. So the new council took a different approach and let the residents put together a 10-year strategic plan. Isabel Massali caught up with those residents to find out if it's made a difference.
They're not elected or trained, but a group of ordinary residents help decide their community's future.
When we vote in people in their councils to make decisions on our behalf, we are actually asking them to be a voice. But many times once people are voted in, they forget about us. So this forum gave us a chance.
That's Helen Malambia, a support worker and mother. In 2018, she was among 40 diverse people chosen by an independent organisation. Their task? To put together a 10-year community plan for their home, the city of Palmerston in Darwin. Mayor Athena Pascoe-Bell believed it was the best way forward for a new council trying to rebuild trust.
It was important that they write the plan without any influence from council members or senior executives. So we really left the plan in their hands and made a commitment that whatever they came up with, we would adopt and then we would start to deliver it. So they were tasked with coming to a consensus about what was important to deliver for the Palmerston community.
In the end, the group decided on six broad categories, like a vibrant economy. And then there are specific targets. A vibrant economy would achieve things like growing the population, more tourists, more businesses, and residents choosing to shop local. So 3 years into the plan, is it working?
There have been a lot of changes, and for someone who attended the forum, as I go around, I see a lot of things which were products of what we discussed and the council taking seriously what the community thought they wanted Palmerston to be like.
Sizzle Fuyana was in high school when she took part in the process. She says she was sceptical at first, but has seen a huge increase in youth activities.
In my opinion, they've always got new activities in there for young people. There's always new spaces for young people in Palmerston, and they are doing a better job than previously with young people, and I'm happy with the way they're handling things. So, and I like the way it represents us rather than what council wants, about what the community wants. So I've seen a big change, and especially from the previous council.
The Palmerston area still has a reputation for crime, and the latest police data shows cases of assault have increased. The mayor says reducing crime is not council's focus, but it's in the plan. So it's taken steps like installing more CCTV cameras, setting up a new youth centre, and banning alcohol from Marlow Lagoon, which has resulted in a drop in police call-outs there. Not everything in the plan has been achieved just yet, but participants say it was a worthwhile experience which gave them a voice.
The general feel of the community is that they are quite happy with the services that council is now providing. So I think it's been a plan that has worked. It has won a few awards now as well. And I think it was very important that we step back, you know, leave our egos behind and listen to what the community wanted the council to deliver.
The concept has been around for years. In 2015, the City of Melbourne embarked on a similar experiment, and it's increasingly being used across Australia. It's known as deliberative democracy, or a citizens' jury, where members of the public directly inform decisions.
It is something that's definitely on the rise, not just in Australia, but around the world. Now, there have probably been thousands of citizens' juries and citizens' assemblies around the world. And in some places, they've been so successful and so effective at building trust in a particular policy-making decision that they've been made permanent. So, for example, in Belgium, we've now moved from ad hoc, you know, one-off citizens' assemblies to something permanent where any citizen in the state of Oost-Belgium and Belgium can expect eventually to be part of this jury system.
That's Associate Professor Ron Levy, who's been studying deliberative democracies. He says people tend not to trust political leaders, but this approach can restore trust.
When you get people who are not members of parties, and most people are not members of parties, they'll tend to make decisions in a far more open-minded way. And so defeating the sort of the scourge or the problem of partisanship is one of the main reasons why we do this. For example, you're changing a city plan or an electoral system. You don't want just some people who might benefit or lose out from that decision to be the decision makers. You want to go out into the community and hear from many people.
Associate Professor Ron Levy from ANU, ending that story about the City of Palmerston's approach to its council decisions and planning. When King Henry, the world's largest known gold rock specimen, was unearthed from an underground mine in Western Australia on Father's Day in 2018, it hit world headlines. The 94-kilogram gold-encrusted rock has now been sold to the Perth Mint for $3 million and is going on permanent public display. Goldfields reporter Jared Lucas was at the Betta Hunt mine near Kambalda when the King Henry specimen was first brought to the surface, and he filed this story for us.
As I watered the dirt down, and there was just gold everywhere. As far as you could see, in my heading, there was just gold everywhere.
Have you, how long have you been an air leg miner?
Been an air leg miner for roughly 16 years.
Ever seen anything like this?
Never in my life have I seen anything like this. I've been in a couple of gold mines, and you see the gold vein in the face, but nothing like this. This was just chunks of gold in the face, on the ground. Truly unique, I reckon.
What did you do?
Well, yeah, after I nearly fell over looking at it, I had a Joe with me, and he helped me start collecting it up and watering it down and so on. And yeah, we were just picking it up for hours.
That was Airleg miner Henry Dole speaking after the discovery of what's now known as the Father's Day vein in September 2018. It produced some of the biggest gold specimens ever seen anywhere in the world. The biggest was 94 kilograms and became known as the King Henry, named after the miner who found it. The gold-covered rock now has a new home. Sold to the Perth Mint for $3 million, it's going on permanent public display.
The fact that it's not melted into another doré bar and people get to actually see it on display for the next 100 or so years, as long as it's around, it's actually very thrilling, actually. Having been in this industry for 34 years, it's nice to see one of the specimens that I've been part of on display forever. So it's a timeless piece, for sure.
The Father's Day vein produced about 30,000 ounces of gold, worth about $40 million, in just a few days. The mine's Canadian owners then took gold specimens, including the King Henry, on a global tour to show investors in the United States, United Kingdom and China the riches at its West Australian mine. Despite fears King Henry might have been sold offshore, Karora Resources CEO Paul Andre Hewitt said the Perth Mint deal is the best case scenario.
Look, there is a lot of people interested in something of this scale and size, but as a company we felt it was right to sell it here in Western Australia and to keep it local. For everyone here to enjoy. So selling it at a discount was important, and leaving it here in WA was also very important to our company.
The government-owned mint dipped into its gold reserves to buy a King Henry, but says it already looks like it was a bargain.
It certainly has gone up in value, but because we didn't have to outlay state funds on it, it's actually a great deal for the state of Western Australia. Typically something like this would trade for, you know, up to two and a half times what its actual gold value is, and given the significance of it being the largest in existence today, it may even have gone somewhat higher than that.
The Perth Mint CEO Richard Hayes says he's well aware of the historical significance of preserving such a unique specimen. In 1931, the biggest gold nugget ever found in Western Australia was dug up at Widgiemooltha. The famed Golden Eagle was later melted down during the Great Depression.
The sad part of Australia's gold history is that so many nuggets found in the early days were melted down for their value, and we're very privileged and proud to have been able to be part of maintaining this part of Australia's cultural heritage for display. The temptation always is for companies to extract the maximum financial value.
And could there be a repeat of the King Henry at Beta Hunt? The ABC was invited to the mine after they recently struck another rich cluster of visible gold. Senior geologist Zaf Thanos explained how the process works.
A truck driver reported that he potentially found gold in one of the truck dumps, and we've come out here for a look, and lo and behold, we found a piece weighing over 100 kilos. So now that we've got our loader operator, we've spread the dirt out, and we're watering it down and picking through it, making sure we collect all the large nuggets.
And what's the process called? Is it truffling? Is that right? I've never heard of that.
Well, since we do it so often, we've termed it truffling. Just like a truffle hog finds truffles with your hands down and burying, digging through the dirt. It was initially named after our foreman, who you can see behind you there. Yeah, he loves it. He's good at it. We've termed it truffling, as we do it quite often.
It's not a normal term.
No, it's definitely site-specific.
And this is the third time I've been lucky enough to be invited out to the Beta Hunt mine for a pretty rare find, but it's becoming less rare, isn't it?
Yeah, it's becoming a bit of a first-world mining problem, this one. We've got finding great little pockets of gold. we're still in the right geologic environment, so we do expect hopefully to find some more in the near future as well.
I think Jared Lucas was as excited as he is. That was senior geologist Zaph Thanis, ending that story from Jared Lucas. And if you do have time, do check out Jared's photos on ABC on the website there. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.